Are we going to have fun today?
I got everything ready to wrap.
All right.
Four bills, 5 minutes, 25 seconds is the record. You get it out. So we got two bills, so we got 2 minutes.
I don't think that's going to happen today.
Senator Edwards?
Yeah. Morning.
The Senate Committee on Finance and Revenue is open. Good morning, everyone. Let's start off with a public hearing on House Bill 2083. I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2083.
Okay. Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. House Bill 2083 is relating to the Senior and Disabled Deferral Program. And what the measure would do is the measure would create an exception to the 5-year ownership requirement for the homestead or claimant for deferral if claimants for deferral moved to a homestead from a homestead that was previously qualifying. And they sell the existing qualifying or previously qualified property within 1 year, and the new property that the existing participant moves to is less value than the existing or the previous property they're at, and they put 80% down of the new homestead. So it's really about downsizing, allowing an individual who was previously in the program to move to a new home of lesser value with 20% down and still continue to qualify under the new home. It also requires a homestead to be insured for fire and other casualty, and allows the Department of Revenue to purchase insurance for uninsured homestead for the fire casualty and add the cost of insurance coverage to the lien. The bill also increases the county median real market value qualification limits for taxpayers that have continuously owned and lived in a homestead of at least 21 years. And it requires the Department of Revenue to electronically notify Office of Aging and Disability Resource Connection or Seniors and People with Disabilities Division of Department of Human Services if recertification is not received within 35 days after sending notification to taxpayer. So if you remember, the committee made changes the legislature made changes in previous sessions to require a recertification of existing participants no less than every 3 years. And so these changes would essentially increase the outreach for participants that don't initially respond to the mailing sent out by the Department of Revenue. And then the changes would apply to property tax years beginning on or after July 1st, 2016. We do have the paperwork, but I'm happy to describe that after the public hearing if you'd like, or at this time.
At this time.
Okay. So the fiscal, that's up in OLIS, it is minimal. The revenue impact is up there in OLIS as well. And for the revenue impact, it's really... three of the four changes are going to have an impact on revenue. The first would be the change in the 5-year ownership requirement. So right now, if an individual, say they sell their home, they'd repay their lien on their existing home, but under an existing law, they'd have to wait 5 years before they could come into the program under the new, with their new homestead. The change to the bill would allow them to come in more or less immediately, so that would increase, in some cases, the number of participants in the program because they would no longer have to wait that 5 years. The increase in the RMV limits is for those that have continuously lived in their home for 21 years or more. So that would, if you remember in the program, the way it is set up now is there is an RMV limit for the homestead, but it's based upon the number of years you've been in the home. So the more years you've been in the home, the higher your RMV limit is for that home. And this would increase that RMV limit for individuals that have been in their home for 21 years or more. So it would give a few more individuals who have some of those higher RMVs but have been in their home for those 21 years or more would be able to qualify for the program, so it would increase some participation there. And there's also an assumption with the recertification outreach that there would be more properties that would continuously receive the property tax deferral. So right now, the Department of Revenue is certifying every 2 years recertifications. And just by doing that process, people or individuals that are participating will fall out for numerous reasons. Possibly they don't get their paperwork in on time or something on those lines. So there's an assumption that by increasing the outreach, more individuals will continuously participate. So the revenue change in the bill is actually the change to deferral revolving account. So in the short term, you'd see a decrease in the revolving account reflective of the increased payments going out each November. Of course, in the long term, there will be more repayments coming in reflective of the greater participation. So in the short term, it's a negative hit to the revolving account, but in years out, you'd see a little bit of an increase.
Okay.
And then the fourth change is just the insurance requirement. Department of Revenue sees very little use of this in the future. It would be on a really a small basis, so there's no real impact there.
Okay, we have some representatives from Multnomah County. You want to come forward, Lee Gerard, Chris Vick, and your team. Signed up here. And in the OLIS materials, we have a letter of support from Multnomah County Commission Chair Deborah Kafoury.
Good morning, Chair Hass, members of the committee. For the record, Chris Vick with Multnomah County. Thank you for holding a hearing this morning on this bill. What I'd like to do is provide a little bit of additional background, because I know it's been a while since the committee's heard about the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program, explain the origin of how we decided to bring these changes forth to the legislature, provide a brief overview of those changes, and point out that we don't think this bill goes far enough, but for this session, we're very happy with these changes that are before you today. So as Kyle was just describing, the Senior Property Tax Deferral Program has been around since the 60s. It's a revolving account. The state has provided the seed funds. So when a senior enrolls in the program, an eligible senior enrolls in the program, there's a lien placed on their house for the amount of property taxes that are deferred annually. And local governments are made whole every year by this fund. When the property that's in the program changes ownership, the lien is then exercised, the state gets the funds back, and the program can continue and has a decent amount of a decent record of solvency. During the recession, there were a couple changes that needed to be made to the program because some funds were borrowed from the program for Oregon Project Independence, and there was a spike in enrollment around the recession and some declines in real market value. So a lot of these requirements have had a short shelf life. And we're now seeing some unintended consequences that we think deserve to be remedied. And most of those changes were made starting in 2011. These changes came about because our commissioners, when they were out talking to folks in the community, found that, like I said, there were some unintended consequences. People who had lived in their homes for a long time had suddenly seen rapid gentrification around them and were now priced out of the program. Other seniors wanted to downsize their homes, but because of the five-year residency requirement, couldn't then immediately re-enroll in the program and were stuck in homes that were too large and more expensive than they desired. The issue of fire insurance, we learned that a couple seniors in Multnomah County were kicked out of the program because they didn't have fire insurance. We've since explored that a little bit more with the department and decided to insert into this bill the opportunity for DOR to force purchase fire insurance if need be, or to purchase it with the approval of the senior if they so choose. The forced purchase idea came about after, in consultation with DOR, we realized DOR could have a $100,000 lien on a property that's been in the program for a long time, but could potentially lose that lien if a fire or another disaster occurred that rendered the property unusable. So the department does have this new discretion to potentially force purchase in fire insurance and ensure their current investment in the program. We don't think that these changes go far enough. One of the restrictions that was put on just over the past couple of years has been the exclusion of folks that have reverse mortgages. And reverse mortgages, as this committee probably knows, can come in all different shapes and sizes. And just because someone has a reverse mortgage doesn't mean that it would threaten the solvency or the lien that the Department of Revenue has placed on a property. For example, if someone were to take out a reverse mortgage for a very modest amount, let's say they have $300,000 in equity in their property, and they take out $25,000 to move their laundry room upstairs to make their space more livable, that $25,000 reverse mortgage isn't likely to threaten the additional $275,000 worth of equity that that senior has in their house. But the way the law is currently written, they couldn't be in the senior deferral program. It was pointed out to us, though, that the Department of Revenue doesn't have the capacity right now to properly assess the type of reverse mortgage. There were some questions about seniors divulging that type of information to the agency. So at this point, we're backing off of that request, but it is something that we think deserves some additional attention as people move forward, as this program moves forward. Seniors are increasingly going to be reliant due to lack of retirement savings on these type of financial tools. So we think it's something that's worth exploring in future legislative sessions to make it more palatable and a more useful tool for people who do have reverse mortgages. With that, I'll turn it over to Lee. We'll be happy to answer any questions.
Good morning, Chair Haas and committee members. I'm Lee Girard, and I'm a senior manager with Multnomah County Aging, Disability, and Veteran Services Division, and I'm here today asking for your support for House Bill 2083. Our agency is a member of a four-county Aging, Disability, and Resource Connection Consortium, and we're also the designated area agency on aging and disability services for Multnomah County. And this year, we've been administering the distribution of one-time financial assistance to older adults experiencing financial hardship during the 3 years that they were excluded from the senior property tax deferral program. And that was funding that was actually allocated by the legislature. House Bill 2083 supports older adults being able to age in place in their communities. Oregon is nationally known for providing older adults with a variety of care options that allow them to remain in their homes and connected to their communities. In Oregon, almost 50% of individuals receiving Medicaid long-term care services and supports receive their care in their own home. So they're remaining at home and getting long-term care supports. Maintaining older adults in their homes helps them to utilize their resources more effectively and avoid or postpone the need for more costly public assistance. A significant challenge for people remaining at home as their care needs increase is having affordable housing options. As older adults on fixed incomes age, the cost of home ownership can become a bigger portion of their limited incomes. The changes proposed by House Bill 2083 are important to ensure that older adults who are at higher risk financially have access to the senior property tax deferral program. We also support the requirement that the Department of Revenue share with the Department of Human Services and the Aging and Disability Resource Connection the lists of current applicants who fail to re-enroll in a given year, giving the Aging and Disability Resource Connection programs at the local community 30 days to assist the applicants before removing them from the program. In administering the one-time financial assistance to older adults who experience financial hardship, our agency has found that many individuals have significant barriers and challenges in completing the application process. We also found that many of these individuals have other needs that can be addressed by our local aging and disability networks. Examples have included people needing assistance with the Department of Revenue application because they may have some cognition issues, they may have literacy issues, or they may even have issues like vision and hearing issues that make it hard for them to complete an application. Many of the people that we've connected with this past year have needed assistance accessing financial counseling and money management services. So these kinds of activities will help people remain independent more longer term. We also have provided information, referral, and assistance to help people access public benefits that they may be eligible for, including such things as the SNAP nutrition service program, utility assistance, and energy assistance that continues to make it more affordable for them to remain in their homes. And then we've also connected them to a wide variety of services supporting them in their community. Thank you for considering this bill, and I'd be happy to answer any questions you have.
Okay. Mr. Assessor.
Good morning. Chair Haas, members of the committee. My name is Randy Waller. I'm the Multnomah County Director of Assessment, Recording, and Taxation. I'm here today primarily to answer any technical questions you'd have around how the market's reacting out there. But there's three key factors in here for my office. We interact with the citizens quite a bit. One of our jobs is tax collections, and we process applications, send them to the state. And then if the people end up not in the program, we end up dealing with them after that. But when the application process came into play when the program was changed 4, 5, 6 years ago, we decided to start having our appraisers go out in the field. And that's where we ended up partnering with Lee and her team. And the provision of the social service connection is critical. I won't reiterate what Lee just said, but my appraisers go out in the field. Since I have them in the field, we start knocking on doors. And we're finding that if this problem is here in Multnomah County, what is it like throughout the rest of the state? And so Lee's been collaborating with people around the state on how the provisions in this bill could be implemented to help fill that gap somewhat. Even this year, we still have over 100 people that we connected with that they would not have been in the program if it wasn't for our appraisers knocking on their door. And hopefully I'll be able to pass this off to other social service agencies in the future. My appraisers will keep appraising property. But we had a vested interest in it because we do not need those people not in the program and their properties go delinquent, and then I end up having to go into a foreclosure action. That's the social service aspect. The valuation caps, we found that we have a number of people, as Chris mentioned, in the gentrified areas. This will help alleviate some of that problem where we have people right on that cusp and all of a sudden they're $4,000 or $5,000 over the income limit. They've lived in their homes for 20 years, been in the program that long. They truly don't have the resources. And you can combine that with the downsizing requirement, where we had numerous people say, well, I'm stuck here because I can't downsize and then be in the programs. And so these three main components to this, from my standpoint in my office, are critical to help alleviate a little bit of the problem here we've had in the last couple of years. And I'd be happy to answer any questions, absolutely.
Questions? Senator Berkshire.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just one question on mortgages. So conventional loans, I understand that the part of the loan payment is usually the taxes. That's all taken care of by the financial institution. How about private loans that have a first on a home? Does that first still stay in first position over taxation if somebody is under this program?
Chair Hass, Senator Berchiger. If there's still a mortgage or a reverse mortgage, yes, they have priority on any lien.
So the state's in second position.
Correct.
Thank you.
Further questions? Okay. Are you okay?
Fine. Yeah. I just had
okay.
to get that.
Thank you, Multnomah County. John Mullen has signed up to testify on this.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, John Mullen with the Oregon Law Center. I have a few comments that I want to make in support of this bill. And first of all, I want to thank Multnomah County for their great work on this. But I want to emphasize that this is an issue for advocates statewide. And while we appreciate the leadership from Multnomah County, the issues that affect this population are statewide. Just by very quick reference, I've been working on this issue for a long time prior to when I came to the Oregon Law Center as director of Clackamas County Social Services. I worked with then Senator Vern Duncan and a disability advocate to add people with disabilities to the program. He was able to successfully live in his own home till the end of his life because of that particular program. What members of the committee that have been around on Revenue Committee know about what's happened over time is that in 2009, when the program was basically insolvent, there were a number of issues that went into making that happen. One was changes in the housing market, but there were also the changes that happened because of the use of the fund for other purposes, including for Oregon Project Independence most recently. So the legislature, I think, took prudent steps under those circumstances to make changes to the program. However, from an advocacy point of view, we immediately began taking a look at ways in which the program could be improved and people could be added back. So just basically, just to underscore the support that's there from a number of different advocates around the state, House Bill 2083 is a really very good step forward. It also has a minimal impact on the corpus, which is, I think, a prudent thing. But I also really want to underscore that I agree with Multnomah County in saying that more changes are needed. Of course, in a bigger picture scheme of things, this committee has considered other issues related to property tax, including a homestead exemption. In the future, I think these discussions will also need to be targeted at thinking about how any changes in the property tax system affects vulnerable people and helping them to stay in their own homes. Thank you for the opportunity to testify. And again, I want to thank Multnomah County for the great work, and hopefully you will consider passing this bill.
Questions? Thank you, John. Okay, that's everyone who signed up to testify. I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2083. And at the risk of not having any preliminary vote counting intel here, I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2083.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2083 to the floor to pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2083 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with the due pass recommendation. Any discussion? I just want to say thanks to Multnomah County as well. This bill kind of trapped up a few other bills that had some ingredients of this, so in some ways it was a catch-all for two or three other senior property tax deferral bills that have been bouncing around the building, so that's good. Any objections to House Bill 2083? Seeing none, House Bill 2083 goes to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Senator Riley, excuse me for asking this, but are you a senior? Do you fall into that category?
I do, actually, yes.
Would you mind carrying this bill?
I don't mind at all.
Okay, thank you. Then I will close the work session on House Bill 2083. I was being put on the spot.
We're witnesses. I think that's discrimination.
Yeah.
Can I file a lawsuit on that? I
don't know. Probably.
If you recover extra of your 98 cents per hour wage.
And open up a public hearing on House Bill 2486.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2486, the engrossed version, it is a bill that comes to us from the Department of Revenue. And what it would do is it would remove the statutory provisions relating to the categorization of property tax revenue under Measure 5 that were held unconstitutional by Oregon courts and take effect on the 91st day following adjournment sine die. So up in OLIS, you'll find under the media materials for 2486, there is a copy of the Yerhausen versus Eugene decision, which is really the court decision that necessitates the change in the statute. So the tax court and the Oregon Supreme Court upheld that provisions subs 2 and 3 of ORS 310-155 are unconstitutional, and they have to they relate to the Measure 5 limits under general government and education. So as the committee is aware, there is the $5 and $10 limits, and the decision of the courts were essentially it's not where the property tax levies are coming from, but it's how the money is spent decides how the limits are applied. So regardless if, say, it funds are coming from a county levy, if they're being spent maybe 50-50 to support education and 50% to support a county, then you would have to subject half of that levy amount to the Measure 5 limits under the education side and half under the general government side. And so what the bill is doing is just updating statute to reflect the court's decision and interpretation of the Constitution.
Okay. The Department of Revenue is here to talk about this. John Phillips.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, John Phillips of the Department of Revenue. And I think Kyle has pretty much said it all. If you have any questions, I'd be happy to answer them.
Senator Boquist.
Okay, I don't really care who answers the question, Mr. Chair, but I'm trying to figure out the bill here.
I have the basic idea here, but I'm looking at the court proceeding documents and declares ORS 310 sub 3 unconstitutional. I get that portion of it, which is lines 14 to 17 on the bill. I don't find any reference to a declaration of sub 2 being declared unconstitutional, so help me out here. And then I see we've done the typical Scrivener, which is probably not your where we deleted one paragraph and we took the exact same wording and put it in another place. So what are we doing, and does two really apply to this, and give us a practical application. Since the court was so good to give us virtually nothing in there other than he said, she said, they did, and we haven't got a clue what they're talking about.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I'll start with the Scrivener's comments about legislative council's changes to the definition. Essentially, you're absolutely correct. Educational services is in the bill. If you turn to page 2, it's right there. It was just moved up in the list because it was educational services includes, and then later it said educational services does not include. I think LC felt that that was more appropriately placed in the same subsection.
Job justification for lawyers. Got it. Okay.
The other question you had is regarding subsections 2 and 3, and you're correct. The Supreme Court did rule, and the tax court did rule, that subsection, I believe it was 3, was unconstitutional. And since 2 is an actual literal parrot of the same thing, the reasoning would be the same, that it's fundamentally it's not the entity that categorizes and levies the tax, but it's really the end use of the money. And so the principle is the same in the and those two subsections are really parroting one another, and for the same reasons they would be equally unconstitutional.
Follow up, Senator Boquist.
Okay, I'm curious. I even grasped that. The question is, I'm trying to figure out, is why did these lawyers write, and they're not exactly the same. They just sort of mean the same thing. So any guess why, and this was before all of our time, why we wrote Section 2 and Section 3, which supposedly sort of say the same thing, but we wrote it in two different ways? Any guess at all?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, as to why they were separated into two different subsections, I don't know, other than I just think they were trying to clarify that for each category there was going to be a comment and relating to the specific units of local government that would be levying, certifying, or imposing those taxes and the specific category. So that's all I can suspicion.
You must be at least familiar with the court case. Can you just give us as the chair says, a real-world English example of what happened here in real world? And they obviously filed and said something, a practical application. I'm fearful that I might have to carry this, so I want to be able to say something.
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I'd be happy to. There have been a number of cases since 1990 that have discussed the categorization. The Shiloh decision was also a significant case that bears on this issue also. But for this particular case, the city of, I believe it was Eugene, was levying taxes. There was an issue in that particular case whether the use of the money was exclusive. And I think the arguments were, was the levy exclusively to be used for educational purposes, or were there portions of the levy that were to be exclusively used for? And I think they were trying to dissect or sort out the distinction between what does exclusively used mean. And what the court was opining on in this particular situation was that if a unit of local government, regardless of the type of local government, whether it's a park and rec district or a school district or a city, is levying taxes that will be intended for the use of another, a category that they typically wouldn't levy into, the education category in this case, then they say that the people, in their constitutional adoption of Measure 5, intended that you don't sort of circumvent the limitations by having another unit of local government levy a tax and then spend it in the other area. So I think that's what they were trying to do, and the court found that the city needed to categorize that under the education category. And
So if presently they were splitting it in half, and what the court is saying and what we're trying to do right now is say if the city of Eugene goes out again, they're going to have to say in their levy, this is for education, it goes here. You can't have two parts. You have to say this is for education or this is for general government. You can't split the two in half. Is that what we're sort of saying here?
Mr. Chair, Senator Boquist, I think it would allow a unit of local government to certify under both categories if that's the appropriate intended use of those monies. There is currently a case, McGuire, in Portland right now, where they're litigating the next step to that, which is the question of the Urban Renewal District for Portland Development Commission is actually has plans to do work at the PSU campus. I don't know if you've read about that in the paper, but there's improvements they're planning on funding. And so the question there is whether or not anything that an urban renewal agency does is could be considered to be other than removing blight, and which is a general government function. So that's if you'll notice, this is an Ann Gross version. And so some of the bill before you saw it had additional language about urban renewal agencies categorizing, and that part was removed because that case is still pending. So this is just the bare bones Supreme Court ruling on the statute cleanup.
Question of staff, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Give me an example. Somebody's got to carry this on the floor. So what's a hypothetical example?
Yeah,
you're good at this because the chair gives you this question all the time. You should rehearse this.
Senator Boquist, I think the example of the court case is probably the best one, and the Department of Revenue kind of hit on this, where the city of Eugene was going out for a levy, but part of those funds were going to be spent on the education side, yet all of it would fall under the compression, the Measure 5 test on the general government side, which on average throughout the state is going to be a higher threshold because there's just more likely you're going to be in compression on the education side rather than the general government side. So I think the worry would be that you'd actually, in the end result, you could be levying more tax by not making the split based upon how the levy is being spent.
Okay. So a good example of that would be that if you had a $10 million levy and you were going to spend $6 million on education and $4 million on general government, you'd have to put that in your ballot material. But then when it was calculated, the $6 million would fall under the education category and the $4 million would fall under the general government?
That's correct.
This basically is making an allocation that says you have to split the allocation appropriately.
Yes, that's
correct. I got it. Thank you.
And Mr. Chair, I'd be happy to provide you with, more detailed examples for any kind of a floor speech the senator might have.
So just to make sure.
Okay.
I'm looking down the deal. So we have, you could either do two levies. They could have gone out for two levies, or you do one levy, and in the ballot title and all that stuff, you'd say this is how we calculate it, which would make those assessors sitting in the back room have cardiac arrest, but that's okay. This allows us to still do it. You could still go out for a $10 million levy. You just have to clarify it. And then the calculations of compression would be done differently. And then, this other thing we did in rules that said this is an estimate only. Everybody will jump up and down and throw apples and oranges at us. Got it. So.
Yes.
Okay. I'm fine, Mr. Chair. I just clarifying.
Okay.
He's fine. We did, if I could add, we did have conversations with the bond councils in Portland that advise urban renewal agencies and the League of Oregon Cities, and they expressed confidence in this version. They had some hesitation about the earlier version. That's why we went ahead and provided some amendments, and that's why you have the Ann Gross version that you do today. So,
all right. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Close the public hearing on House Bill 2486 and open up a work session on House Bill 2486.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2486 to the floor with a due pass.
Senator Boquist moves House Bill 2486 to the floor of the Oregon State Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? Senator Bart Scherer.
You talk. You
Mr. Chair, I'll be honest with you, and it might be, as my kids say, my bad. I just don't have my arms around this bill yet. That doesn't mean I won't be a yes on the floor, but I'm going to be a no in committee until I can ask a few more questions and have a few more conversations, if that makes sense.
Well, I'll just do a little poll of the committee. If you would like to wait a day or two on this, that'd be fine with me. I think the sun will come up tomorrow whether we vote this out today or not.
It's fine. You do whatever you want. Yeah.
All right. Well,
I appreciate it.
We'll carry a work session over.
I withdraw my motion, Mr. Chair.
And Senator Boquist withdraws his motion. So we'll carry this over for a future date and close the work session.
That's what he's carrying.
And so that clears our decks. I want to remind everyone, tomorrow we have our joint tax credit committee hearing at this place at 8:30. And I also, and Paul will be sending an email to committee members on the House side and the Senate side and that committee that look at where we are with the numbers and some options to make things balance out. Paul, do you want to come up?
Yes, Mr. Chair. Paul Warner, the State Revenue Office. As we speak, I'm sure Chris is working on the table that basically goes through the sunsetted credits you had hearings on, and starts with a base from those that didn't come forward from the policy committee, so you don't have them all in there. We're assuming that's your starting point. We have a list of things that you've discussed in the tax credit meetings, the joint meetings around potential what we call offsets. They are early sunsets. So one we've talked about, for example, was long-term care insurance credit, where the policy committees recommend not extending it. One potential offset would be to move that sunset up 12 months and make it apply to 2015. So those are that would be part of it. You've talked about the Conway decision on credits and corporate minimum taxes. So that's another potential offset. So we have those listed. And then the co-chairs met yesterday and kind of listed out some other potential issues from the revenue committees that have been talked about. So those will be on kind of a third list of what possible things to consider. And then I know that the co-chairs talked about an opportunity to add other things to that list as you continue to talk about it in the joint committee.
So tomorrow will be a day of discussion. No real parade of witnesses testifying on their ideas or their bills, but really just to try to have a robust discussion from the House and Senate members on that committee.
Yes. We have posted House Bill 2093, which is just a shell. So that'll you'll see that when you look at that sheet, kind of the worksheet, that will really become the basis for 2093 and the elements you decide to put in.
The discussion will be around a public hearing on that bill then.
Yes, yeah. Correct.
Senator Boquist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. You mentioned, Paul, that the co-chairs had sent comments or notes, which will be seen. Did they send a check with those two? Or are we still at $14 million?
Mr.
Boquist.
Senator Boquist, Mr. Vice Chair. The check must have got lost in the mail somewhere. Well, we were still checking for that. No, the target they gave us is the word we're using is $14 million. So, and that, of course, is something that is a potential target, and we're recognizing there could be some movement around that.
So Mr. Chair, on my side, return receipt, not accepted. No checking, no comments.
All right, so that's tomorrow. And I would encourage you to talk to your caucuses or colleagues or friends or tax attorneys and others about the CAT idea, the amendment we adopted the other day in Senate Bill 126?
Oh, the Senate Bill is 925.
925, sorry. I get those two mixed up. Just do your homework. Okay.
Lots of homework today.
Nothing else before us. We will adjourn.
Thanks for adjourn.